When did you move to the Barossa?
Well, I moved to the Barossa in 1970, and which was also the year that Peter and I married. So I came, I got a job at Newry High and taught there for just over 2 years, and then started breeding.
So what were your first impressions of the Barossa Valley, Margaret?
Very much an interlocked, interwoven community. That was something that, and of course marrying Peter and being in the wine industry, wine, as we know, is a very, very good social lubricant, shall I say. And so I was drawn into the world and the way of thinking and the way of doing. And I think probably from my point of view, coming from a totally English migrant background, my father was born in Manchester and my mother's people came out in the 1840s from Kent. So she was born in Australia and, of course, was I. His father was born in Manchester, and I just suddenly realised, well, of course, I couldn't stand for Parliament because of him, which gave me a bit of a shock. One was the role of men. This is the most extraordinary thing for me. I grew up in a household where my father couldn't find the kitchen. He could maybe boil water. I do not recall him even making a cup of tea until much later in life, but as I was growing up. My mother was a school teacher. She did the whole bloody lot. Coming here, I found I would stand side by side with men in the butcher shop and they selected the meat. They knew what they were talking about. And, of course, this flowed from, I think, the pickling, preserving, the killing the pig tradition that came from the very earliest settlers. I mean, Peter talked about his mother's memories of killing the pig and the grotty jobs that women had to do, which was stirring the blood for the black pudding till it thickened, and she didn't enjoy that very much. But that it was, and again, it was a communal pastime. We gathered all the hands. And, of course, you knew everybody loved their tummies in an obvious way. And so, for example, when I came here, Angaston had Schultz and Turner's Butchers. At one stage it had three. The third one didn't last very long. But you went to Turner's for beef and you knew, and you went to Schultz for pork and Fritz and his bacon and smoked Gordon's. And, of course, people had their vegetable gardens. I mean, you followed the seasons of the year, which you didn't so overtly in town. My mother used to grow vegetables and we had fruit trees and she'd make jam and so on. And one of the old Adelaide blocks, which one of those characteristics in Adelaide, because I grew up in Leabrook, were large blocks, and the backyards had fruit trees, and we had chooks in the early years until the council changed the regulations associated with chooks. And my mother grew up on an orchard in Lenswood, so we were so far removed from the soil, but it was moving into the rhythm of the seasons, I think. Because this is most obvious. Now, of course, it's pruning time. Then you... And so much, of course, because Peter was a winemaker, revolved around the grape. He was a very keen vegetable grower. And that was just... You timed it, and when the frogs started croaking in the creek, that's the time to plant your melons and your cucumbers and so on. Because that was a natural phenomenon. And the thing that really struck me, and again, we had met different bakers. So in Angaston, they specialised in one sort of bread. Newry had Linky's Bakery. And quite often I found when I was planning a dinner party or something, because we had to entertain a lot, I'd start thinking about the bread, and then I'd think where I'd get it from, because each of the bakers and the butchers had their own flavours for whatever. And so you would actually have a range of providers because they had their own recipes, they were distinctive. The thing that really struck me was that you swapped vegetables and you knew where your food came from and you knew the hands that had been growing it, making it, creating it. And that was the most important. And for Barossan, Angie Hudson wrote, I hate that word, but she finally found she had to use it. It was always waste, not want, not, don't throw that out. And I'd finally say, well, it was a very frugal, saving culture, as I'm sure you know from your background. And of course, some of the distinctive elements of our food still today is not to waste anything, and in times of abundance, you preserved it. And so making wine was a way of preserving the grape.
Sometimes you're not tuned in with it to know. Well, I suppose here you would be, because it's very much part of your life. But, you know, city life, it's...
Well, you're not so aware. And you just go... I drive through some of the streets of Adelaide now with the high rises, and I think, well, how do you know what's happening outside? Because it's... and here... I love the fact that I look out in the vineyards and then you look out and some trees are defoliated and that means I can see the birds and it is the time to do this, and then you'll have the conversation, and still, even with... There's been a recognition as probably the generation that went to school in the 20s, having no English, because German or Deutsch, Brosser Deutsch, stayed as a community language for so much longer, and it was a community language because of the nature of the very first migration from Silesia, from Prussia. They weren't Germans, because Germany only became a construct after Bismarck banged everybody's heads together, and it was not until 1871. So they were Silesians or Hanoverians or Prussians or whatever first. But because the condition of migration from Frederick Wilhelm III was that you take your troublesome priest with you. So you migrated with the pastor. And so people settled and in regions, and so Ibenica is different from Eden Valley. And Peter and I, some years ago, Peter's father laid the foundation stones of the Eden Valley, St. Petri, and it was a centenary, and the same families who helped found it are still attending that church today, not in such numbers, because we know that church attendance is declining. But there, and I looked, and I've had this sense of the distinctiveness of the Eden Valley community. And if you go to others, there are ways of doing things which relate to from whence they came, because there's a very strong unity and linkage. Of course, land has now been bought and sold, but before, it was very much a solid little community. And because where they settled, they built church, didn't have a squabble, as Peter said. They came out seeking religious freedom, and by golly, they took it. And so you've got four Lutheran churches in Tanunda, and you've got two at Light Pass, a telephone box, post boxes, a state school and so on. So I used the cucumber salad. So we used the urna method, that's Peter's mother, and that's come down, and so that's the way we have been told. Now, there are some who slice and don't weight, in other words, salt and don't weight it. There are some who grate it, and that is, and salt and weight, and you are you a peeler, are you a slicer, are you a grater, are you a waiter? And it actually differs around different parts of the Barossa, which I find quite... So there are elements still where you still have territories which you can say, well, that's Nildna territory out this neck of the woods, and that's the Hargies up there, and Light Passes, the Shoals, the Gropies, the Bames, and so on. And that, so that it held as community language because the preachers came out from Germany and they didn't have English. And so they preached in German because, and so God spoke German.
A lot of people have referred to this over the last few weeks to me, of like their first experience really of learning English was starting school, and they used to get, if they were speaking any Deutsch in school, they'd get either the slap or there'd be the lines, you know, the discipline of trying to get them to stop
speaking. Bearing in mind, there was also, and Peter had the opposite experience, his father was a pastor, his mother grew up in during World War One. Over North Peninsula, because there's a significant Lutheran patching settlements there, Linkies and Heidenreichs and names like that. And she went to school having no English, and she swore that that would not happen with her child. And the only time Peter recalls German being spoken in the house was when parents didn't want the kids to know what was being said. But he grew up speaking English and picking up a little bit. But going to church still, he could turn off. As he said, listening to interminable sermons in German when I didn't understand a word was appalling. And also, if ever we went to church together, he'd wriggle, shuffle, squirm, turn round, because it just... But Peter's father was very rare because he did his theological degree in America and not in Germany, and St. Paul, Minnesota. Minneapolis, St. Paul, his certificates there, that seminary is still there. Had an American friend from that neck of the woods said, my God, that's still there. It's just around the corner from where I grew up. And then in World War II, when they were allowed only one German service a month, Peter's father was in huge demand because he was one of the rare pastors who could preach in English. And I think that's forgotten. So if you take the isolation, the grouping of the settlements, the fact that it was around the churches, and those are now the second and sort of maybe third generation coming up. Hence the strength of retention of the community language, so that you could still have people who now in their seventies and eighties who went to school having no children born. In the '30s you're in your very late 80s. You're 88 if you were born in 1930, which is Peter Norton Schluter was born in 1930, from the Greenock Creek Cabin.
That's really interesting about the services. His father preaching in English.
Being able to. And also they lived in Angston. He never lived in a manse. And he built his own home. It's still there on McCulter Road. And so he was never beholden to the church wardens and the, in a way that some of the other pastors, because he went to Emmanuel, a lot of his fellow students went on to become pastors.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, being at Emmanuel, a German school, they were called Germans, erroneously, in my view. That's why you've got to be so careful with language. I get very cross. That was such a binding experience because you were being attacked by all these people who were terribly patriotic. And as usual, patriotism, once somebody gets very patriotic, intelligence, cool-headed analysis, examination flies out the window and irrationality rules the day. You see, my father, when he was principal of the Teachers College, and he and Peter were like chalk and cheese. And my father was an academic. He got his doctorate in educational psychology. He got a scholarship to go to London. And he could be very pedantic. And his principal, when he was deputy, was Schultz, a man named Schultz, and I can't remember his Christian name. And Schultz was one of these Lutheran migrants.
Mm-hmm.
And I've very carefully called them the Lutheran migration. It's not the German migration. And Dad could see the impact of the bigotry on this man, and he, being at the epicenter with the education department and closing the German schools, which is what they were called, because they taught in German, and there was a German school at like past, there was German at Bethany Church and so on, in the schoolhouse there, in that wonderful Bethany complex. But Dad, he wrote something. And Peter had to write an article, and it was the most poetic. They grew the grapes in German, they picked the grapes in German, they made the wine in German, which summed up that this was the lingua franca, this was the everyday.
Mm.
But Peter didn't, and he kept saying, when we get to Germany, the people, turn a tap and out will come all these words. But they didn't, I can assure you. And I can remember when I was teaching at Newry High, the first stirrings of real pride, and it was the Schilling family history. And kids brought it to school, I remember, in a red cover, and bound, and photographed. That, to my knowledge, is the first major production of a fully bound, hardcover book, not a pamphlet. Serious people have done enormous amount of research, and the kids brought it to school in pride. And much to the horror of some of the teachers, they'd come up and say, "I'm related to you." Oh God! And it was when people took pride in this ancestry and that part of their. And so in the 60s, I mean, when you think war stopped 45, so in 1960, you're 15 years, it's very, very, still very raw, lively, and so on. And so it's 25 years, 1970, and for people to, 25 years isn't
it's that, not long.
Not long. Mm. And so it's very much within your living cord of memory. And then, of course, you've got those amazing paradoxes when you go around the Barossa and you have a look at the war memorials and the names on them.
Mm.
And you think, goodness me. And you look at the Barossa cookery book and the new one, because that Barossa cookery book was World War One and it was raised money and it's for the Soldiers Memorial Hall, and it's still selling very well and still raising money for the Soldiers Memorial Hall, which is now the Regional Gallery. There are very few recipes for the Silesian foods.
Mm-hmm.
It's mainly The cakes, the biscuits. Oh, there's some pickles and preserves. But not, I think there's only one for sour gherkins.
And why is that?
Because you proved that you were part of the mainstream. Mm. You had assimilated into the British Empire. Now, of course, people are very proud and you get cross marriages and I think it's called marrying out. And Angie's got, she did a monograph on that, so that's really something, and how she worked it out. She's an absolute fount of, if I want to know anything, I'll ring Angie. So what you're getting is a very impressionistic picture of somebody from an English background coming. And I found that the men were is involved in the food one way and another as women, and each had the foods that they were responsible for, and that you could have, you would have a discussion of an intensity that was just amazing about the quality of a fish from one rock hole to another. I just found this extraordinary. And when people, when they started, Colin Grant started the dill pickles, so they brought back some of the traditional things into the Tanunda Show arena to have pride. So it was the pickle, so it was the pickled onions and the sour gherkins, and Colin Grant set that up. And everybody, they were judged like wine, and they had three for colour and three for this. And they all had white coats and clipboards and so on. And when Peter was in the Weybridge, and of course, and they knew he was a sour gherkin judge, so suddenly they'd appear from everywhere. But the arguments about what, which particular leaves, it was the, and some people swore by cherry. Others said it had to be Mataro. Others was Grenache. And nothing else would do but to use those particular grape leaves, which those blokes believed brought a particular quality. Mm-hmm. So that it was very personal. And then whether you just let wild yeast, and others would put in a bit of bread to kick off the ferment. You know, and I loved listening to this. I might add that the blood of sour gherkins dried up when Peter ceased to be a judge. But and then they would, and you hear, no, it's got to be done this way. No. And of course, I pick up, I suppose, it's something that you say, so somebody like Peter wouldn't be able to analyse it the way somebody who, it was all new, and it was a, you see people who've come in from another culture looking at the way people did things absolutely without thinking. This is the, and you, so you say, oh, that's interesting, that's whatever. And so you realise that this is something that's very special. And now in the later years, and I can certainly date it to 1995, where the idea that we must look after and nurture our food traditions, which has picked up and gone through, and this is because Yolumba decided to do the harvest picnic in the Vintage Festival, and so it had all the local little producers and bigger, and they showed how to do traditional foods like rotogrutza, and Linda Croshall used to be there stirring away, and then the smaller producers, and then and I did a launch at the Vintage Festival, I was chair of a committee called, and it all happened spontaneously because I wasn't aware what they were doing up there at Yolumba. But we did the launch called the Winemaker, the Chef, the Butcher, the Baker and the Candlestick Maker, and had these small producers and all the chefs and so on. And everything was specified, so we had 60 blackboards, and everybody's name was mentioned, and these were the hands. These are the hands that are pouring the wine. And now, so in some places the show scene is dying. In Tanunda, the number of, you know, quite often you get, we've got to enter the marble cake competition. There's a bunch of younger, when I say younger, people in their 30s, 40s, and there's a bunch of youngies who I think are young, but women in their, again, 30s, 40s, started the CWA branch up, again in Angaston, where they go and make scones and have a yak. And it's very much a recognition of, and you get looked at, you're not entering in the show. And so that it's reinforcing, rebuilding. And so David and Philip, who are Peter's and my sons, who are both winemakers, Philip made the best, except he called them cornichons, pickled small gherkins. David's been busily making his own sausage with a buy a pig, and it might be not the Metwurst, it'll be, probably be influenced by Italian flavours, but to me that's still continuing the tradition because it's a way of thinking, frame of mind and what you do. And that's still running very strongly through to Barossa. So outsiders come in, embrace it, and quite often the outsiders coming in are the ones who embrace it most readily because they see this is so special and should be nurtured, nourished, treasured and maintained.
That's a really good point. You've just got me thinking of a couple of things there. And Vintage Festival as part of the traditional, the cooking competitions, and it was all pretty serious, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, I can remember in the 80s, Mrs. Frank Stiller used to be the big Deutsche Küchen judge. What was her name? Rosenzweig, what was her Christian name? She was practically chasing Mrs. Stiller around with a bloody knife because she didn't get first prize in a Deutsche Küchen. But so that given the pressures, given everything in this 21st century, I think there's a remarkable, is it a renaissance, a resurgence, awareness amongst particularly those in the wine game, one way and another, because that's so rooted in the soil, bound in the soil, that they want to, anything to go with the wine needs to be equally. So a lot of, so I'd say winemakers do their own olives and do their And so we've got lots of, and say Philip's got an olive grove, so his olives and his olive oil, his and Sarah's, there. Fabulous.
Really?
Yeah, very handy. So it's the doing, and it's the not having the disconnect between where food comes from and what you do. And I think we've fought so hard to maintain the Barossa as a, and the viability of living off the land, living from the land. And we've got some very strong planning laws, and I hope that they are maintained, because it's a mix of, it's quite a complex thing. You can plan and plan and plan, but it's no good to preserve something if people can't earn their living and you restrict them. And that's. But if you say the only way to develop is to build houses or something, it means that your thinking is. So you say no, when you say, are you against development? The answer is no, I'm for development, but growing houses is not quality. But let's enable people to value add to what they're doing. So in the 80s, when you had the vine pool and it was the nadir of the Barossa, and people couldn't earn their living, there were the two things that the then Minister for Environment and Planning worked in tandem, and we on the ground said we will put the value into the name Barossa, so that people, because Barossa was regarded as the pits, as a grape growing region. The cognoscenti and the opinion formers and influencers said the Barossa is only good for growing cabbages. Peter was not impressed.
That was in the 80s.
Well, in 79, we started to get the surpluses, and which is why Peter Lim Wine started. But now, of course, Barossa is very highly prized. And so it makes it easier to preserve something if it's financially viable. And the other thing that happened was in the 80s and so on, the children could not see a future, but now, of course, they can. And so the young are staying or coming back, going away for their education and coming back instead of being grape growers as helpless pawns of the wineries, which is what they were. And now you've got a proliferation of small labels and... it's just astonishing and fabulous.
How many, do you know the figures, roughly?
Oh, I think it's something like 188 wineries. I tell people, this is the manager of Barossa Grape and Wine, I tell people there are approximately 180 Barossa wineries of all shapes and sizes, including Barossa Valley and Eden Valley, because we've got Barossa as an overarching name for the two valleys. There's 81 cellar doors and a lot open by appointment only to make up the final number. That doesn't include 6 in Artisans and the 17 at Taste Eden Valley. Wow. So that's 23.
So it's really quite amazing, isn't it? You think of the sustainability of employment in the Barossa Valley now.
Well, I think what's been happening recently is... I get very excited. There is a range and depth of what people can do. So it ranges, say, from Hentley Farm, where you go and have this absolute gut buster of a degustation where you will get 5 courses and you will pay this, some astronomical sum. Similarly at St Hugo. Absolutely amazing food. You don't order from the thing, you just sit back and it appears, matched with wines, to cellar doors that do little things, but it's also all pretty much emphasis on local foods, to some extraordinarily good restaurants here, and the diversity and what people are offering is just fabulous. And then, of course, you've got all the gins and breweries bringing up, so you've got lots and lots of different forms of potable liquids. When I first came to one, there was not one restaurant. 1970, maybe the Vine Stuber, which is now Pentecostal Church on the corner there, that was the first freestanding restaurant. And that maybe, get the feeling, it was sort of early 70s. I stopped teaching in May 72 and then David was born in July. And if we entertained, you went up to the Angston Hotel, actually, at that time had Jane and Frank Nichols, and Jane was the cook. And of course, the foods we associate with the pub today were not the foods that the pub served because these are frozen. You buy your schnitzels frozen and coated, with, so you pull them out and saw them as you deep fry them. That, or you, you know, salt and pepper squid and things like that, fish and chips. It would be the roast of the day, and Jane actually would make things like oxtail, I think. She certainly had a wonderful tongue with white sauce, caper sauce dish. And we say, oh, goody, tongue's on today. There was no catering service except Helen Hill Smith ran a woman's auxiliary to raise money for the Angaston Hospital, and then for the senior sits at Newry, there was another women's auxiliary, and people like Pat Roish were Shirley Marder. And so they would cater, and it would usually be maybe a barbecue. So you barbecue the whatever, and then make salads and have hot boiled potatoes and so on. Helen and they'd farm out making soups and so on, which might be chicken noodle or a vegetable soup or whatever. And associated with fundraisers, and I'm sure there was something similar, but I came to Angaston first. And Angaston and Tanunda were two very different beasts, and the character, as was Newry, the characteristics are not quite so marked. But Tanunda were the metwurst eaters, and when we were coming down here, I had to explain to Peter that you didn't need a passport or a visa. You didn't have to change money at the border. Because Angaston was the sort of English end of the valley. More, of course, there were plenty of Lutherans, but it's the way the pattern of settlement was.
And was there much interaction between the towns? Do you remember? I mean, there must have been...
Oh, football, but... where they wanted to kill each other. Oh, yes, I mean, people knew each other, but again, you know, people didn't have cars and it had to be how long you could ride a bike, although Peter was madly in love with Pam Schrapel, who I met in later life, and she was a very beautiful one, the Schrapel from Tanunda. John Hoitzenroder, that's Peter's older brother, and my Peter, that was Peter Hoitzenroder's older brother, had a wonderful time talking about the beauteous Pam. So clearly, Peter strayed down to Tanunda. And there was a fair bit of social mixing. Things like the Bacchus Club, there was significant mixing amongst the wine fraternity, the Gramps, the Hill Smiths, and so on. So in that sense... And then, of course, there was the great and noble art of fixing great prices between the leading families, the Salters, the Smiths, the Sepults, the Gramps, that all get on the train and work out how much they were going to pay. It's illegal. I don't know whether it was. So they'd all sit down and just sign. So there was some significant...
They go on, I mean, for many, 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 many years?
I think the government, the state took it over, which was this is the minimum price, and so then if you, and also the payment timings, because it's crucial, because as for both winery and for growers, you've got major outlays, vintage for the grower, it's the pickers, and for the winery, of course, it's the long hours and the extra casual labour you take on. So it's to try and work out the cash flows.
Cash flow, yeah.
But there used to be a train service, and so the Hill Smiths and the Salters, because the Salter family had Saltram, they'd get on at Angaston and then come work its way down, and then, you know, a rolling flat, the Grabs would get on, I presume the Sepults staying to come up to Tanunda or something and catch the train. And then they'd all, and then it'd go down through Lindock, and then they'd sort of all gather in the same carriage, and it was the rawness of the hurt during the wars that still lingered in the most extraordinary way. The older generation who were more exposed to the outside world, if you weren't and you were cocooned to a degree, that to me runs like a dark ribbon. And certainly the English, who of course didn't have anything to worry about, did they? Because they were on the winning side. God was on their side. So,
different view, totally.
But it's not, I mean, the wounds covered up and healed to a degree, but it was always just underneath.
Under the surface, yeah.
Just there, a bit like a subterranean tunnel for those who were exposed to the jeerings and the bigotry and the assumptions.
Suspicion.
And the suspicion. Mm. Which is exactly what's being playing out today with the Muslim communities.
Mm. Yeah, it's the same thing, isn't it?
It's exactly the same thing.
Mm.
And, of course, the more you treat people in this way, the more likely they are quite possibly going to respond and fulfil your assumptions. And you can certainly use a bit of that from Peter, that I reported, said that. He was very, very sensitive and had been sensitised to any form of all people are this or all Germans are that, you know.
Mm-hmm. The pigeonholing of...
Exactly.
You're either this or you're that, yep. Mm.
And this is wrong. People are quick to help you, feel a sense of responsibility for others in that there is a, amongst the wine industry, which is what I really would base a lot of this on, is that there is a generosity to your, what would appear to be your competitors, but you are not. I mean, for David, he's got his little cellar door up there, and the early people who visited were recommended to go there by another winery, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a very strong recognition that you don't have to succeed on the back of somebody else. You actually, if we all succeed, we will all succeed more.
Mm-hmm.